starting in a week or two or three at the most, we will launch into the Gospel of John. If you were with us before we started the life of Paul, we took 3.5 years studying the life of Christ, going chronologically through the Gospels, which of course included a lot of time in John. But there are things about John's Gospel, there are aspects to it that we weren't able to really fully appreciate or appropriate because we were going in a chronological format. We talked, if you were with us, we talked about the sevens, the heptatic structure of Matthew's genealogy last week. There are sevens all the way through John's Gospel, seven miracles, seven I am statements, seven disciples, seven women. And so that will be our focus as we launch into John this year. But before we do that, before we go there, we want to finish 2 Timothy well. And 2 Timothy, ironically, is a book about finishing well. We started chapter 4 last week. We focused, as we did, on the trustworthiness of God's Word. And by the way, I sent out yesterday through Simple Church some follow-up resources, and I'm going to send out more this coming week, but a few more things, several more things worth harvesting in 2 Timothy 4 before we move on. And I thought this morning, as we begin 2026 together, I thought we would look at what Paul means by finishing well so that we can begin this year with the end in mind. 2 Timothy 4, we read last week, Paul telling Timothy, verse 5, to be watchful in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. Timothy, you do that because I'm a little busy right now. Paul is in a dungeon somewhere in Rome. And he says, verse 6, I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I've fought the good fight. I've finished the race. I've kept the faith. Finally, there's laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Poured out like a drink offering. I read that like the broken down jock that I am, ex-jock. And what I hear Paul saying, the first thing that I hear him saying is, Timothy, leave it all on the field. I had a high school football coach who drilled that into us. If you played the sport right, if you played the sport well, you'll leave it all on the field. You'll crawl to the sideline at the end of the game. You'll have to be helped into your car. You won't have anything left. And that was certainly true for Paul. By the time he's writing this letter, Paul's been serving the Lord 30-some years. And over those years, he's traveled miles and miles. He's been beaten. He's been shipwrecked. He's been starved. He's been imprisoned. And he's currently both imprisoned and mistreated and abandoned. So, verse 6, we can easily imagine Paul saying, anything the Lord has asked me to do, I've done. Anything that I ever had to give, I've gladly handed over. It sounds like Paul is saying that because he is saying that. But this metaphor of the drink offering, this rich metaphor that we read in verse 6, I think holds even more than that. And as we look at this last chapter of 2 Timothy together, I want to propose four different ways we can look at that verse and specifically that metaphor, that idea of the drink offering. We'll come back next week and we'll unpack some more. But this morning as we begin a new year together, four things I think the Lord would have us notice about being poured out, about redeeming our time in 2026. Reality, deity, security, and testimony. Pretty clear from the short passage that we just read, and really from the whole letter. Pretty clear, Paul is writing well aware of his reality. I've finished the race. I've kept the faith. There's a crown waiting. Paul understands that martyrdom is in his near future. He doesn't think that he's going to live to see another year. He knows he's going to stand before Jesus soon. He's accepted that that's his reality. And yet, even with that being the case, he says, notice, I'm being poured out. Present tense. Not, I guess this is it. I've been poured out. It's game over. But You know what? I might be approaching the finish line, but I'm still being poured out. I still have something left to give, and I'm giving it. With his death imminent. I mean, close enough that Paul could probably hear the executioner start to sharpen his axe. We see Paul all the more determined to redeem whatever days, however many, the Lord had left for him. With whatever he had left to give. Paul wasn't blind to his reality. He knew however many days he did or didn't have, he was behind bars. He knew that he wasn't able to minister the way that he had in years past. The days of his long missionary journeys were behind him. He wasn't going to be planting new churches. He wasn't even going to be visiting and encouraging existing churches. He wasn't going to be running a school of ministry the way that he had in Ephesus. He probably realized that he wasn't able to write great letters of doctrine like his letter to the Romans. It was probably too dark. He might well have been too weak. But rather than giving up, rather than rolling over and saying, well, I can't do the ministry I've always done, so I'm not going to do any ministry at all. Paul did the ministry he could. He did the ministry his circumstances allowed. He did the ministry that God called him to in this unique season of his life. He's mentoring, even from a prison cell, he's mentoring the next generation, Timothy and Mark and Titus and Tychicus. He taught them and he trained them out, and he sent them out. But even now, he's writing letters like this. He's writing letters that he can write to encourage them of things that they'd heard from him. Keep on being watchful, verse 5. Keep on enduring afflictions. Keep on preaching the gospel. Keep on fulfilling your ministry. Because it's everything that Paul was doing. That same high school football coach, I'm actually going to visit him next month, loved to quote Teddy Roosevelt. Do what you can with what you have where you are. If you're big, then play big. If you're not big, be fast. If you're not fast, be smart. If you're not smart, well, you better be in better shape than the guy across from you. We look at this last chapter, and it's not just the last chapter of this letter. It's the last chapter of Paul's life. Paul was doing what he could with what he had, where he was. Despite the reality of his circumstances, his age, his infirmity, adversity, imprisonment, impending death, none of it, not even the sum of all of it, could convince him to quit. Instead, it seems to have only spurred him on to pray, Lord, what is it that I do have? What is it that I can do? What is it that you have for me right now, here, today, in this place? And that's a pattern that we see among great men and women of God through the centuries, in the Bible and in church history. You don't see a lot of them retire. Unusual to see any of them settle in and coast to the finish line. Unusual to hear, well, I've done my share, it's somebody else's turn now. And I'm sure you could find counterexamples. But the through line that I see, both in Scripture and through church history, including in Paul's life, our ministry might change, but it doesn't end. Seasons change, people change, places change. And through all of it, the character of our ministry sometimes changes. The activities sometimes shift. But ministry is always there if we're willing to look for it. If we're willing to see it. If we're willing to listen and to hear and obey God's voice calling us to it. Paul's writing his last letter, the final words, and they echo Peter's final words. 2 Peter 1:13, Peter says, I'm going to be crucified upside down soon. That's what's in store for me. But I'm going to take the time that I have left to remind you of a few things, things that are important to always remember and never forget even after I'm gone. Elijah, same thing. Early in Elijah's ministry, it's all prophecies and miracles and dramatic standoffs with pagan priests. Later in his life, 2 Kings 19, after the cave with the earth and the wind and the fire and all of it. God says, yeah, that was then and this is now. The dramatic stuff's in the rearview mirror for you. That's not what we're doing now. That's not this season. That's not this chapter. But that doesn't mean there's still not important stuff. In fact, I've got three guys for you to invest in. Jehu, Hazael, Elisha. They're your ministry now. Jesus. The upper room discourse, which is a little bit of a misnomer because it starts in the upper room, but then he takes the show on the road. As Jesus is walking with his guys to Gethsemane, his season of healing and miracles is over, but he's not done serving. In the hours leading up to his arrest, Jesus is still teaching about love, teaching about the church, teaching about the Holy Spirit, teaching about sanctification. Even hanging on the cross, Jesus is still teaching. He's still instructing. He's still saying, hey, remember this about love and don't forget this about relationships. And know this about forgiveness. And obey this about salvation. That's Paul and Peter and Elijah and Jesus. Where are you at this morning? What's your reality? Life happens to us all. Sometimes in really unexpected ways. Sometimes in really frustrating ways. If we want to find a reason to give up, if we want to find a reason to just hunker down and wait for the rapture, dig ourselves a hole and then pull it in on top of us, if we want to find a reason, the world will give it to us. But God will always give us another option. We can retire in place and wait for Jesus. Or we can take the curveballs that life throws at us as reminders to pray and seek and ask. We can take the curveballs that life throws at us and say, okay, that wasn't what I was expecting. Didn't have that on my list of things to do this week. What does that mean for my ministry? What do you have for me in this season, God? Catching up with some people back in New Jersey over the holidays, it was interesting to hear how many of them are serving in different ministries than when we left 15 years ago. You know, the one whose husband is terminally ill, she shifted from serving in the nursery three services a week to doing card ministry, encouraging people through the mail. Another person, mostly bedridden herself at this point, has become a research assistant to another pastor. And she looks for historical facts and dates and quotes and illustrations. I think even before we left, a dear friend, when he was battling cancer, it affected him enough physically, he shifted from doing children's church to doing nursing home ministry. He said, yeah, they're about my speed. I got a neat note recently from someone who came out of this church who's serving in the military, who said, you know what, I don't have any, my schedule, my life, it's crazy, I'm all over the place. But you know what, I try to send messages from Calvary, from other churches, I try to send messages on to people who are sort of hanging on the fence with Jesus. I try to find messages and I pray, who needs to hear this? And they can do that any hour of the day, and they've taken that as their ministry. Sometimes it goes in the other direction. Sometimes God moves in somebody's life, they're able to do more than they were doing. Don Duncan, founding pastor of this church, was out of ministry. He was retired for 10 years, and then the Lord restored him, revived him, brought him back. Joe Crowley down in Wellington, same thing, was basically had retired from full-time ministry, and the Lord turned his health around, and now 80-some years old, he's running 5 miles a day, and he's in better shape than any of us. I remember a brother who showed up and said, hey, I'm available to serve, and I looked at his background, I looked at his testimony, and I said, where have you been? What have you been doing? Because he had done all of these things. He had all of these training. He had been a chaplain in this place and an assistant pastor in that place. And he said, oh, well, I've been taking care of my wife, but she went home to the Lord, and so now I've got time available. I think about Dakota. Dakota showed up here, what, 7 years ago, 8 years ago? 9 years ago? Wow. He thought he was coming up for 10 days. He said, hey, I'm on break between semesters. Put me to work. Little did he know. The point is, no matter how the Lord has used us in the past, whether we're able mentally, physically, spiritually, relational, whatever, whether we're able to continue in that past ministry or not, even if we had a season on the shelf, the question is always, Lord, what do you have for me today? Are we willing to believe? Are we willing to obey? Are we willing to be poured out? Despite everything, Paul's being poured out. That's the first thing I take away from verse 6. The second thing I see in that verse and in the verses that follow, Paul was being poured out how? He was being poured out like a drink offering. That's a provocative expression. That's not accidental. He could have said, I'm being poured out like a cup of Coke that's gone flat, like a cup of coffee that's gotten cold. I'm being poured out like a bucket dousing a campfire. But he said, no, I'm being poured out like a drink offering. What's a drink offering? Got to go back to Exodus and Numbers to track it down. But a drink offering was wine poured out on the brazen altar at the tabernacle and later the temple with each lamb or bull or other animal being offered. It's one of my favorite pictures in the Old Testament. Because if you visualize that brazen altar, maybe start with our scale. Start with your backyard grill. But then pop it out to more like a barbecue pit, 8 feet square. More area and more depth is more room for fuel, is way, way more heat. So what happens if you lean out to check your steak on your backyard grill and you spill your iced tea? It's going to disappear in a puff of steam about as fast as it hits the coals, right? What's someone watching from across your backyard going to see? They may or may not see you pour out the tea. The motion and the liquid, that may or may not catch their eye, but even if it doesn't, that cloud of steam and that sound of sizzle, that's going to get people's attention. Remember in the 90s, some of you say, nope, I don't. But if you do, remember when it was a big thing for restaurants to carry sizzling fajita platters through the restaurant? Chili's and everybody was doing it. They'd squeeze a lime over it and they'd walk through the restaurant trying not to burn people. Same idea. You know, they'd squeeze lime on it so it would be sizzling as they carried, and everyone would say, oh, look, what's that? Same idea, except that the fajita platter was 64 square feet. And here's the point. After the wine is poured out on the altar, like the lime on the platter, after the cloud evaporates, after the steam dissipates, where are everybody's eyes? What is everybody seeing? What are they looking at? All that's left is the sacrifice. After the drink offering disappears, the sacrifice is what's left to notice. And you can probably guess where this is going, because all of the Mosaic sacrifices and offerings were prophetic, right? Every sacrifice, every offering, along with every feast day and everything else, every aspect of the law, anticipated the future sacrifice of Jesus. In the case of the drink offering, the wine poured on the altar pointed to the blood, Jesus' blood, poured out for us on the cross. What was the second point on our outline? Deity. Deity. Also speaking of Jesus, obviously. Jesus, fully man, fully God. Deity poured into humanity so that he could give his life for us. Here in 2 Timothy 4, and hang with me, because this is so good. Here in 2 Timothy 4, Paul is taking that metaphor, the metaphor of the drink offering, he's applying it to himself. Ultimately, it points to Jesus, but Paul is stepping in and saying, but it's me too. And he's saying to Timothy, it's you too. And he's saying to us this morning, that's what it is to be a Christ follower, to go to the cross every day, to lay down our life every day, to be a drink offering every day. Every day I'm being poured out, Paul says, so that people will see Jesus. Every day I'm being poured out. And as I am, he says in verse 6, every day, if I do it right, every day, as I'm poured out in the name of Jesus, as I'm poured out as a living sacrifice for the sake of the gospel, people shouldn't be noticing me. People will hopefully be looking right past me, right past the man, and seeing Jesus, God who became man. Every day, Paul is saying, every day in my preaching, my teaching, my mentoring, whatever I'm still able to do, every day through my writing, every day my sacrificial service, whatever form it takes, will hopefully be drawing attention, not to me, but to Jesus, the true sacrifice. The purpose of the drink offering was to call attention to the ram, to the lamb, to whatever was on the altar. The purpose of our lives is to call attention to Jesus who died on the cross. I must decrease that he might increase, right? Not Paul's words. That's J the B. That's John the Baptist. But Paul knew those words. He lived those words. And here in his last days, he's more determined than ever to live out those words, to be poured out, not for the sake of people noticing him, but to draw the attention of the crowds, the guards, the kings, the priests, the disciples, the households, the seekers, the skeptics, to draw their attention to Jesus. We live in a day of celebrity pastors, rich and famous worship leaders. There are whole websites devoted to preachers in sneakers. People who stand behind the pulpit wearing $5,000 shoes, literally. There are all kinds of ways that so-called Christian leaders have found to say, hey, look at me. Notice me, see me, appreciate me. I wonder what Paul would have thought about. No, I don't wonder what Paul would. I know what Paul would have thought about that. He tells us right in verse 6. It's not about me. It's never supposed to be about us. The spotlight isn't supposed to be on us. It's always and only supposed to be about the God we're serving. The God who became man to die for our sin. And if we are genuinely serving, if we're truly presenting ourselves to God as living sacrifices, poured out on the altar to call attention to the greater sacrifice, then our ministry isn't a function of comfort and it's not a function of choice. It really just comes down to obedience. And if it costs, well, that's to be expected, isn't it? Sacrificial service implies sacrifice. Paul doesn't call us to be living volunteers, showing up in places and time of our choosing to do the things we like doing. He calls us to be servants who show up in places and times of God's choosing to do the ministry he finds necessary. We're called to live in the shadows, to forego fame and fortune for the privilege of what? Pointing people to Jesus. And our pride fights back, doesn't it? Our pride resists that. And it's always going to until we see Jesus face to face. I skipped a page, Lizzie, but that's okay. Our souls are saved, but we dwell in bodies of sin, bodies that cry out like little children, notice me, look at me, see me. Which is another reason Paul says in verse 6 that he's being poured out, present ongoing condition. Because on this side of heaven, we'll never be done. We choose to be poured out daily. We choose to lay down our pride daily. We choose to die to self daily. We choose to crucify our flesh daily. And the way that we do that is by choosing God daily and asking Him to crowd those other things out, drawing close to God in His Word daily, being filled with the Holy Spirit daily, choosing, deciding to love people daily, reminding ourselves daily, not my will, but your will. Not my fame, but your fame. You don't notice the wonderful team in the media booth until there's feedback. Until the TVs flicker, and then everybody turns around. What are you doing? You don't notice a good cameraman. Don't notice a good sound engineer. Don't notice a good salesperson. You walk into Best Buy. You notice the person who chases you around because they're on commission. You notice the person who follows you because they want to show off how much they know about the washing machine you're not sure that you're going to buy. The best salesperson is what? Invisible until you say, wait, I have a question. And then they appear as if by magic. We need to keep reminding ourselves daily, we're not the show. We're not here for ourselves. We're not here to be noticed. We're not here so that someone watching can say, oh, what a great cup of iced tea he is. Look at that huge steam cloud he's making. Boy, he really sizzles, doesn't he? No, we're here so that when we serve, people say, what was that over there? Where? I don't know. There was something, but what's that that's left? Well, it's Jesus. What's that smell hanging in the air? That's the fragrance of Christ. God who became man, God who humbled himself, God who poured his deity into human form so that his blood could be poured out. So we could be appreciated? So we could be famous? No, so we could be forgiven. Which brings us to our third point. Paul was being poured out. That was his reality. Paul was being poured out like a drink offering to point to the deity of Jesus. Third point, he was being poured out, as in all the way out. Not drizzle, drizzle, drizzle. Okay, that's enough. Not pour, 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 pour. Okay, need to... No, emptied, drained, dry, all of it, holding nothing back. Being poured out with no concern whatsoever for his own security. And let's just cut to the chase on this one, right? Is that us? Okay, God, I'm willing to be poured out. Am I willing to be poured all the way out? Holding nothing back. It's how we're called to serve. If we're drink offerings, and that's what Paul is saying, if we're drink offerings, then we're sacrifices. And we get to show up that way. We get to present ourselves as living sacrifices. And there's no reason not to. There's no reason to hold anything back because our real lives are waiting for us. The drink offering of this life, everything that we have to give in this life, that's a drop. That's a single drop in the ocean of eternity. And that's an eternity that no one or nothing can take away. So we have nothing to lose. The worst thing this world can do to us is send us to Jesus early. So in the meantime, we get to live holy, unreservedly, entirely, and completely for God and others. Do we do that? We sing, I will offer up my life in spirit and truth. Do we live up to those lyrics? I think the answer is probably not the way that we could. And I think I'm speaking for all of us. I don't think I've ever met anyone who is consistently, perfectly, unequivocally laying down their life to Jesus every moment of every day. Because we're still human. And even if we decide that we want to, and that's a big if right there. Even if we say, yes, Lord. 2026, I'm all in. The world and Satan and our own flesh are going to gang up and they're going to shout the same message at us. I mean, you got to hold something back. You got to play it just a little bit safe. You got to look out for yourself because no one else is going to. The world and Satan and our own flesh all conspire to tell us, to try to persuade us. We need to look out for us. We need to pay attention to our own security. The world and Satan and our own flesh will tell us we need to be afraid. We need to be very afraid of being hurt. They'll gang up to remind us of all the times that we've been hurt. And they'll warn us if we step out to serve the Lord the way that the songs that we sing tell us, if we decide that we're going to be poured out like a drink offering the way that Paul exhorts us, oh, you're just asking to be hurt again. So maybe we better not. Patrick, look out, are you going to get hurt? And we reflexively respond to that, right? Look out, you're going to get hurt. We reflexively respond to that because we don't like pain. I don't. I don't know about the rest of you. But I think most of us know we don't like pain because we've tried it and didn't like it. We've tried it, we didn't like it, so we do our best to avoid it. But another way of saying that, we tend to make safety, we tend to make security a priority even above ministry, even above living in Christian community. I mean, true or false? We tend to look at people, especially in the context of ministry, especially in the context of Christian community, and we wonder to ourselves, even as we engage with them, are you going to be the next one to hurt me? The next one to lie to me? The next one to disappoint me? The next one to disappear? The next one to betray me? Are you going to hurt me? And because we're not sure, because we can't be sure, we tend to be careful, right? A lot of the time, we're cautious about diving into new ministries, to new relationships. We're just stick the big toe in and see how it is for a while. Test things out. I run into that pretty consistently, pretty regularly. Hey, would you be interested in taking this on? Would you be willing to commit to this? Would you be willing to try this? Hey, are you ready to lean in? I don't know. Yeah, I haven't made up my mind. I haven't really heard from the Lord. Which is sometimes true. But it's sometimes true because we haven't asked the Lord, because we don't want to hear from the Lord, because He might tell us to do the thing we're afraid of. Oh, I don't know. I haven't heard from the Lord. Sometimes that's real, and I'm not disparaging that, but sometimes it's code for, yeah, I'm not sure I feel safe. Sometimes there's genuine things to pray through. And a lot of times there's calendar issues and schedule issues, real conflicts with other commitments. But I think more often than we want to admit, it's fear somewhere in there prompting us to say, yeah, I'll have to let you know. How about if we play it by ear? What if we just take it week by week? Call me if you really get into a jam so I can say no later instead of saying no now. When I figure out that's what somebody is doing, I try to grab them and make it easy for them. I try to grab them and say, hey, let me save you a lot of trouble. If you're trying to figure out whether you're going to get hurt in ministry, if you're trying to figure out if you're going to get hurt in this Christian community, let me help you out. Yes, you will. 100%. And I get why that's not an appealing thought. People look at me and say, wow, that's a strange recruiting pitch you have. But I have these conversations on the regular with people who say, yeah, I haven't really leaned into the community because I've been hurt. I've been hurt by pastors. I've been hurt by fathers. I've been hurt by men. I've been hurt by people. And I've been trying to figure out if you're going to hurt me too. You as in Calvary or you speaking of me. And again, I say, let me simplify your life. Yes. Sooner or later, I will fail you because I'm human. And P.S., so is everybody else who makes up this family. So is everyone that you'll serve with. So is everyone that you'll serve. And Paul knew that better than anybody. Paul wrote 2 Corinthians 11. He talked about his history in ministry, in labors, in stripes, in prisons, beaten, stoned, shipwrecked, long journeys with perils, robbers, perils of his own countrymen, perils among false brethren. And Paul was talking about real things that happened in his life, but metaphorically speaking, that's all of us. We might not travel the way that Paul traveled. We might not do the things that he did, but labors, when you step out to serve, you'll realize that all people notice is what isn't done. Stripes. People put labels on you that once they're there, they won't be able to see past. Prisons. We end up typecast a lot of times. People decide, well, that's who he is and he's not going to change. Beaten, literally or figuratively, because someone isn't what I wanted them to be. Stoned. People decide that you're of no value and they leave you for dead. Shipwrecked. Sometimes we shipwreck ourselves. Sometimes we look at the lack of fruit in our lives and our ministries and it challenges our faith. Journeys. We're in places that we didn't plan on going with, people we didn't plan on being with. Robbers who take without giving. Countrymen. Jesus knew sometimes it's the people closest to us who take advantage of that proximity to hurt us. False brethren who come in talking about Jesus but turn out to have their own agenda. That's why in a lot of denominations, pastors rotate every 2 years. That's why we tell stories about the man marooned on a desert island, and when the ship comes after years to rescue him, they find three huts there on the beach. And the crew rescuing him says, What's that hut there? He says, oh, that's where I live. That's my shelter. That's my house. Well, what's that other hut? Oh, that's my church. That's where I go on the first day of every week to worship God. Okay, well, what's that third hut? Oh, that. It's where I used to go to church. we laugh about it because there's some truth there. We're used to this pattern where we use each other up, where we give up, where we move on, hoping that the next church, the next pastor, the next people will be different, except, spoiler alert, it won't be, because people are people wherever we go. No one can guarantee that church will always be safe. Quite the opposite. Jesus promised us, as Christ's followers, we will get hurt. Paul knew that. Jesus lived that. Jesus did ministry perfectly, and they killed him for it. But what was Jesus doing the night before he was crucified? Knowing he was going to be crucified, Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen in the next 24 hours. What's he doing? He's teaching, mentoring, ministering, praying, washing feet, including whose? Including Peter's, including Judas's. Jesus knew Peter would deny him. Jesus had known forever that Judas was going to betray him, and he served them anyway because that's why he came. He came to serve. He came to be poured out. And he wanted us to understand that's what being poured out entails. It's not holding back behind some imaginary shield of security, because there is no such thing. There isn't perfect safety in the church. There isn't safety in this life. The only security we'll ever find anywhere ever is the security we find in God. Paul understood that. When we read further next week, he's going to talk about Demas forsaking him, Alexander the coppersmith doing much harm to him. I don't think that Paul was shocked. If those things happened to Jesus, of course they were going to happen to him. And we should understand, of course they're going to happen to us. But it's not a reason to run away from community. Quite the opposite. It's a reason to run toward community. Because whatever pain is waiting for us in serving, whatever betrayal we experience after trusting, whatever loneliness we might end up feeling, even in the middle of a crowd, no place lonelier than in the middle of a crowd. But that's the same hurt, that's the same sadness, that's the same loneliness that happens to everyone. That's part of the human condition. It's not always the fault or the failure of a particular church family. Sometimes it is. But mostly it's the fault and failure of a broken creation filled with broken people. And the only remedy for the human condition, the brokenness that we all see, the brokenness that we all share, the only remedy for that is Jesus. Not people, not ministry, not even community. And who better to tell people that the answer for all their pain and all their trouble is Jesus than people like us who have needed that answer and cried out for that answer and have found that answer and are still daily finding that answer because we haven't stopped needing that answer. Who better to tell the world about Jesus than people watching and praying and rejoicing and clinging to Jesus as that answer, even as we ourselves are being poured out, watching Him stand by us, watching Him strengthen us. So the message that He's given us would be preached by us, not beggars who found bread, because that implies that it's over and done with and all in the past. No, we're beggars who are finding afresh each day our daily bread in Christ Jesus and sharing it, sharing Him. I'm not a preacher. I'm not someone to tell people about Jesus. Yeah, you are. When Paul, back in verse 2, when Paul said, preach the word, he's talking to all of us. We do that in different ways. Sunday morning, we do that in different ways. The welcome team and the welcome team greets people and before they experience anything else. Hopefully they experience the love of Jesus. The hospitality team is trying to express the abundance of Jesus. The prayer team is reminding us of the power of Jesus. The maintenance crew is serving behind the scenes so that we can keep our focus on Jesus. Children's church is bringing the truth of the gospel to a level that's accessible so that even small children can learn about Jesus. And that goes on outside of these walls. When I choose to love my wife, I'm saying to anyone who's watching, hey, this is how Jesus loves me. When we choose to reject gossip and say, no, Jesus talks to us, Satan talks about us, we're reminding people about the character of Jesus. When we open our door and invite our neighbors, we're saying, hey, Jesus goes first. Jesus took initiative. When we reply to the skeptics and the cynics in our life with love and confidence, hey, that's interesting. Who told you that? Where did that idea come from? That's interesting to me. Can you show me? We're showing people the grace and the long suffering of Jesus. Bottom line, if we wake up in the morning and we say, here I am, God, use me, He will. And your life will preach the gospel. And words may or may not have anything to do with it. But with or without words, you will preach the gospel. You will do the work of an evangelist because that's so much of why we're here. Worship and witness. And as we do that, back to verse 5, yeah, we'll endure afflictions. Many of you already have. Many of you currently are. All of us will. And we shouldn't be surprised. Again, Jesus tells us that's what it'll be like. But as we wrap up this morning, can I encourage you to pour that out too? The pain, the scars, the things you've done, the things that were done to you. As you invite God, as you allow God to pour you out, let Him pour that out too. Make that part of your offering. Pour out your testimony. your life before becoming a Christian, how you became a Christian, the things that God has brought you through since becoming a Christian. Okay, now that's scary, Patrick. God can have my time and my talent and my treasure. And he can have his way with my comfort and my convenience and my health, but not my past. Not what happened. Not what I did. Not what was done to me. I don't want to think about that stuff. I don't want to talk about that stuff. It's dirty. It's horrible. It's hurtful. It's painful. Which is why God says to us, yeah, so don't leave it in the cup. Pour it out. Let me have it. Let me use it. Make it part of your offering to me and watch what I can do with it. Here's what we forget too much of the time. Jesus died for guilt and shame. Guilt is the fact of our sin. Shame is the feeling we have about that sin. But when we're saved, when we're new creations in Christ Jesus, he removes our guilt and in the process eliminates any need for shame. If the guilt isn't there, then we don't need to feel anything about it other than grateful. We certainly don't need to feel guilty, dirty, stained, ashamed anymore. Whether the thing happened 10 years ago, or 10 months ago, or 10 days ago, or 10 minutes ago. Whether it's something we did or something that was done to us, we can say, Jesus, take it. Jesus, deal with it. Because I want to be done with it. Are we willing to believe that? Willing to put legs to that? Willing to agree with God? This is who I was. This is what I did. This is what was done to me. But none of it's who I am. Because who I am is who I am in you. Are we willing to remember our past without constantly reliving or finding ourselves stuck in our past? Can we talk about things that have affected us without letting them define us? Are we willing to pour out the people we were and declare to ourselves and anybody else paying attention, that might have been who I was, but who I am is a child of God. I'm beloved and precious in His sight. I'm called by His name. Satan knows our name, calls us by our sin. God knows our sin, calls us by our name, and calls us by His name. God calls us by His name. We're not the sum of the sin that we've committed. And we're not the sum of the stuff that people have inflicted on us, have committed against us. We're redeemed. And we nod and we say, yeah, Jesus redeemed my soul. But are we willing to let Him continue His work of redemption in the rest of our lives? Are we willing to let Him redeem our past? Are we willing to let Him use our stories? Are we willing to pour those out, whatever they are? Are we willing to let those be an offering? A few weeks ago in youth study, a few of the teams were talking about their testimonies. And a couple of them sound a little sheepish. Sometimes I think I need to quit school and leave home and join Hell's Angels and ride around and do a bunch of crimes so I actually have a story to tell. I told them, and I'll say the same thing to everyone here, you have a story. Whoever you are, whatever has happened to bring you to this place, you've got a story. And whoever you are, someone needs to hear that story. Someone needs to hear about exactly the kind of mercy you've received and how God met you in the middle of whatever you were going through. Because if He let you go through it, whatever it was, if God lets us go through it, He wants to redeem it. And one way He does that is by putting people in our life who need to hear all about it. How God showed up and met us in it. How we're different on this side of it. Someone needs to hear that story. Are we willing to let Him use us to tell them? And it's worth deciding that now. It's worth deciding today you're willing to let your story be part of your offering to the Lord. Because just like any other ministry, the opportunities that God gives us don't come at places and times that we're expecting or planning. He brings them when He brings them, and He doesn't bring them to punish us. He brings them because they're a privilege. It's a privilege to be able to say, this is who I was. This is who Jesus is. This is what I did. This is what Jesus did with it. This is what was done to me. This is who Jesus is to me. And if the idea of doing it seems impossibly hard, maybe the first person you need to share your story with is you. Oh, you don't understand how bad it was. Probably not, but what has God done with it? Before we can tell our own story, we need to know our own story. It's possible we need to sit with our own story until we see God in it, until His mercy shines out of it, until His grace is the point of it. Because here's the thing, the more we had to be forgiven, the more we had to forgive, the deeper the pit we needed to be pulled out of, the greater the story of God's mercy we get to tell. Dennis, you probably should make your way back up here. Romans 8:28, all things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. God doesn't change the past, but He can forgive the past, and He does. He can redeem our past, and He does. He can use our past, and He does. He can use our past, whatever it was, to influence somebody else's present, to assure somebody else's future. Are we willing to let Him? Are we willing to say, my history is now His story? God, it's yours to use how you see fit. Are we willing to let Him use it? Are we willing to let Him keep writing it? Gail Irwin was always fond of asking rhetorically, why didn't God write the gospel in the sky? Why didn't He put a big set of loudspeakers on the moon? And the answer is because love is always retail. It's not wholesale. You can't buy it in bulk. They don't sell it at Costco. Love is one person at a time, one soul at a time, one conversation at a time. Conversation between two broken people, at least one of them mindful of their reality, willing to use everything, even their story, to share the good news of Jesus. Jesus, fully man and fully God. Jesus, perfect in His humanity and His deity, who came to rescue us from ourselves. How better to bring that message of hope to the world than being people daily clinging to that hope, daily being changed by that hope, being transformed by that hope. And the world sees it most clearly when we let ourselves be poured out. When we take everything that we are, everything that God saved us from, everything that He saved us to, and pour it out in one lifelong offering to the world that says, amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved me. I was so stinking lost. But God found me. He opened my eyes. Are you willing to see the grace that He offers?